Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 8th, 2025. We are delighted to host this discussion entitled, Can State Courts Set Global Climate Policy? My name is Matthew Sautel, and I am an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have as our speakers, Mr. David Bookbinder, Professor Michael Gerard, Professor Donald Cochin, and Mr. Adam White. And we are honored to have Mr. Michael Buschbacher as our moderator. Mr. Buschbacher is a partner at Boyden Gray PLLC, where he leads the firm's energy and environmental law practice. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom, so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask the questions submitted there both pertain to the discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Buschbacher, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Matthew. And it is an honor to be moderating today's discussion about a topic that I think, in my view at least, has received far too little attention. As the promotional page for this event says, climate change has been described as a super wicked policy problem. And what does that mean? I think Professor Ricky Lazarus at Harvard has a sort of good discussion of this. He says it's an area that defies resolution, not only because of the enormous interdependencies, uncertainties, circularities, and conflicting stakeholders implicated by any effort to develop a solution, but also because time is not costless. And while the threat and harms are uncertain and largely confined to the distant future, the costs will largely have to be borne in the much nearer term. I find it helpful in thinking about climate policy generally to break things into kind of two groups of climate policy wonks, the techno-optimists on the one hand and the degrowthers on the other. The optimists see that we've made a lot of progress already. Improvements in efficiency, new tech, mitigation strategies, and the like are what they emphasize. And for these folks, innovation and investment are the key. Degrowthers, by contrast, note that improving efficiency, lowering costs, and the like has a rebound effect that actually just leads to greater consumption, not to lower emissions overall. And much of the world is still developing. So on this view, tech is definitely not a panacea. And what we need to do is to live more within our means as a species. And this is where you get the things like plant-based diets, public transit, dense housing, fewer people, that kind of rhetoric. So techno-optimism is obviously a more palatable brand for policymakers, and that's often where Congress and presidents and the global community have put emphasis. But critics have an easy rejoinder to this, which is that global carbon emissions keep rising. Now, some, like our current Energy Secretary Chris Wright, have said that, you know, as significant as the challenges from climate change may be, they are not the biggest challenges we face, not by a long shot, in their view. Matthew Burgess, for instance, has shown that if we end up with what's called medium climate sensitivity, in other words, the impact of greater CO2 in the troposphere is either neither extreme nor negligible, somewhere in the middle, then we're likely to have warming around, I think, 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, which is hardly a catastrophe. But not everyone has the same risk tolerance about the sensitivity of the climate or the same optimism that some policymakers like Chris Wright do about tech reducing emissions. And that includes many blue state attorneys general and blue city law departments. Now, these folks generally can't make the law, but they have the authority to enforce it. And over the last few decades, a cadre of creative lawyers, with help from donors and centers like the Sabin Center at NYU, have sought to leverage that law enforcement authority to take energy companies to court, alleging that these companies' production, marketing, and sale of fossil fuels has proximately caused various climate injuries. That means things like increased flooding, hurricanes, and the like. And these suits together, and there are dozens of them, seek billions and by some accounting, even trillions of dollars in damages. And they advance two main theories of liability, public nuisance and consumer protection. The nuisance theory identifies the production and sale of fossil fuels as a kind of pollution that energy companies need to pay for and abate. Consumer protection theory gets to the same place in the end, I think, but in a little bit more roundabout way. It's more like the climate. It's more like the tobacco litigation of several decades ago. And this theory claims that energy companies knew about the risks of climate change and chose to mislead or downplay those risks to the public in order to increase consumption of fossil fuels and make a profit. Now, while climate litigation like this has been going on for a long time, most of this last several years have been focused on preliminary issues, things that are, you know, classic FedSoc topics, like federal officer removal and things like that, but that are perhaps a bit removed from the actual policy implications. But now the courts are rolling around to actually getting to deciding things on the merits. Some recent state court decisions have held that these claims are preempted or precluded by federal law. Specifically, they've held that one, federal common law is the exclusive avenue by which a state can seek damages arising from out-of-state emissions. And two, that the Clean Air Act provides a comprehensive legislative regulatory regime that displaces federal common law, and that this means that states are simply left without a cause of action for trying to police out-of-state emissions. The argument on the other side is that the Clean Air Act's displacement of federal common law actually opened up the door to state regulations, regulation of out-of-state emissions, because the legal standard for displacement and preemption are different. That's one big question here, but many others remain open as well. For instance, how can you show proximate causation and injury? Bad weather is, of course, not new. So how do you show that emissions from company X caused injury Y from a hurricane or whatever? And how do you show that the fossil fuels wouldn't have been consumed anyway? Indeed, I think every state in the union requires, in some circumstances, the sale of natural gas, which is used to generate electricity, heat homes, and run appliances and the like. There are also constitutional questions, particularly under the First Amendment, whether consumer protection theories here run into a free speech problem. And then there's the practical problem of how to allocate damages. State-owned companies, for instance, are protected by sovereign immunity. So, you know, the China National Petroleum Corporation is not a defendant in, I think, any of these suits, but their oil and gas contribute to global emissions the same as anyone else's. And ultimately, the biggest question, I think, is if these suits are successful, will they reduce global carbon emissions, or will it just be a payday for contingency fee lawyers and an opportunity for virtue signaling from progressive politicians? These issues and more have been debated extensively already, and we have a truly outstanding panel of experts here to discuss these things, and in classic Federalist Society style, to have real differing viewpoints. And I'm very much looking forward to this discussion. Kicking us off will be Professor Michael Girard, who is the Andrew Sabin Professor of Professional Practice and the founder and faculty director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School. Professor Girard is not just a leading theorist. He's a real practitioner with a distinguished environmental litigation record from his time as a partner at Arnold and Porter in New York. Then we'll hear from Professor Donald Cochin, who's professor of law and executive director of the Law and Economics Center at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Professor Cochin is a prolific and oft-cited scholar. He's a member of the American Law Institute and an expert on property law, natural resources, and environmental law, law and economics, and many other topics. We'll then hear from from David Bookbinder, who is currently the Director of Law and Policy at the Environmental Integrity Project. Before that, he was a top climate lawyer at the Sierra Club, where he was a part of the team that brought and eventually won one of the biggest climate cases in U.S. history, Massachusetts versus EPA. He also worked at the Office of the Massachusetts Attorney General and at Paul Weiss until, and this just cracked me up when I read it in his bio, he, quote, got tired of litigation where the result was a wire transfer from entity A to entity B. And last, we'll hear from Adam White, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the director of Scalia Law's C. Boyden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. The Boyden connections run quite deep with Adam. He was previously a partner at my firm, Boyden Gray PLLC, and he's one of the leading conservative administrative law scholars out there, and among many other accomplishments, was selected by President Biden to serve on the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court, where he criticized court packing. So the format today will be, we'll give about 8 or so minutes for each of the panelists to give opening remarks. I'll then give an opportunity for them to respond to each other. Before we go into a moderated Q&A, I'll have some questions of my own, but as Matthew mentioned, please put your questions in the chat and I will get to as many as I can. And with that, Professor Girard, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Let me try to share my screen here. Okay. How does that look? Okay. So the Sabin Center has a website with a database that attempts to have all of the climate change cases in the world, both in the US and abroad. Just last week, we changed the platform for it to an AI-based platform. So all more than 3,000 cases and 15,000 accompanying documents are word searchable and searchable in various other ways on this database that is free for all to use. On a global basis, we see that climate change litigation really took off around 2007. And you can see in green are the US cases and in orange are the cases elsewhere in the world. The U.S. is by far the champion, if you want to call it that, in climate litigation. We have about 2/3 of all the world's climate cases. At latest count, almost 2,000 climate cases in the U.S. Of the cases in the U.S., by far the largest number are under either the National Environmental Policy Act or its state equivalents, mostly California, concerning environmental impact review. A lot of cases under the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, and other laws. Only a very small fraction of total U.S. cases are the common law and related claims that we're talking about, but those get a great deal of attention. Of the common law cases, the most important in some ways was this lawsuit that was brought in 2004 by Connecticut and several other states against several power companies seeking an injunction that they reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. That case ultimately went up to the Supreme Court. It had been brought under a federal common law of nuisance theory, and the Supreme Court said that the federal common law of nuisance is displaced by the Clean Air Act. They left open the question of whether the state common law could apply. There was simultaneously another case pending brought by the village of Kivalina, Alaska, seeking not an injunction, which the American Electric Power case was seeking, but money damages. And the Ninth Circuit ruled that the American Electric Power rule applied to money damage cases as well. So nothing much happened until 2017, when we saw the first of a wave of lawsuits brought under state common law theories. By my latest count, is there about 33 of them. They're not brought under federal common law of nuisance. The Supreme Court has ruled that out. They're brought under state, public, and private nuisance, negligence, trespass, products liability, and consumer protection theories. The major oil companies are the defendants in most or all of them, plus the American Petroleum Institute. They seek compensatory damages, although not enumerated, equitable relief, including a fund to pay for adaptation and mitigation. Some seek punitive damages, some seek disgorgement of profits and attorney's fees. The one case that was brought initially of this group that was brought initially in federal court rather than state court led to a Second Circuit decision finding that these state law cases also may not proceed. Three of the cases have reached their state's top court. And in all of those, the cases have survived the motions to dismiss. In Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court allowed that case to proceed. Further motion practice is anticipated and discovery is now underway. The city and county of Honolulu sued. The Hawaii Supreme Court upheld that. There was a major effort by the defendants to seek Supreme Court review. The Supreme Court denied cert. Several motions for partial summary judgment have been filed and discovery is underway there. And most recently in Boulder County case, the Colorado Supreme Court filed a case which has survived the Colorado Supreme Court, and a cert petition was filed there in August. A lot of activity in the lower courts. As you can see, several of the cases here in the lower courts have been dismissed. Almost all of those are being appealed. The Maryland Supreme Court just on Monday heard argument in the cases brought by Baltimore, Annapolis, and Anne Arundel County. There are other cases, as you can see, that are brought by these other cities and states and counties, and most of those are being appealed. In several other cases, the trial court denied the motion to dismiss. And in most of these, the other side is appealing. So these are all very active cases. In a couple of the cases, they were brought in state court. The defendants removed to federal court, and they've been remanded back to state court, city of Chicago, and most recently, a couple of weeks ago, the state of Maine. And then there are some new cases where we don't have any decisions yet from the state of Hawaii, from a town in North Carolina, and the estate of a woman who died in a heat wave and is claiming that was caused by climate change. Now, a lot of issues come up in these cases, but there's some facts that nobody is contesting in any of these cases. Nobody is contesting in these cases that fossil fuel emissions are contributing to climate change or that climate change will have negative impacts. There's a lot of contestation, as you've heard, about just how negative they're going to be. But nobody's arguing they don't have negative impacts. And there is general agreement that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is an authoritative source on climate change. Some of the issues that are contested, as I say, whether they're in state or federal court has pretty much been decided. They're in state court. As you've heard, probably the number one defense we're hearing is that these cases are preempted by the Clean Air Act. Now, of course, the Trump administration has proposed to revoke the endangerment finding, which is the legal basis for EPA action under the Clean Air Act. And if that action goes forward, there will be strong arguments that the preemption defense no longer applies, since the Clean Air Act no longer applies to greenhouse gases. There are arguments that the foreign affairs power preempts, questions about the ability to impose liability for out-of-state conduct, availability of joint and several liability. I don't have time to get into it, but there are a large number of legal issues that arise addressing whether there is liability here. And there's an even larger number of factual questions that arise. Who caused what damage? How much of the climate change that we know is happening is caused by natural variability versus anthropogenic climate change? How would we divide up the damages? Many, many issues that are yet to be litigated. But if any of these cases do get to trial, I think we'll see very serious litigation about them. Well, I think my 8 minutes are up, and I look forward to the further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Cochin?
Great. Thank you so much for those introductory comments. I think you've set the stage well, Professor Gerard. And I'm going to try to outline a few different buckets of concerns that were highlighted already, I think, in the opening, but perhaps I'll go a little deeper on some of them. One thing that I think is important to highlight is the trajectory of these claims. As was mentioned, AP versus Connecticut shut out the possibility of bringing claims based on federal common law. And there was a quick pivot by the plaintiffs in these cases to start bringing cases instead based on state law claims. And that's really why you see this evolution over time as a reactive evolution, depending on how the courts are viewing things. Originally, there were cases being filed in state and federal courts based on these state law claims. But I think that the federal courts started to acknowledge some reservations about hearing these cases, including key decisions coming out of New York and coming out of California, and some other federal courts that indicated a less willingness to perhaps allow these cases to go forward, and arguing some of those same kind of problems, or identifying some of those same kind of problems that were mentioned, including whether or not AP versus Connecticut should extend to state law claims. Consequently, the plaintiffs have been creative and effective at bringing state law claims in state courts. And so just the one missing part of the story then is this trajectory, and also the attempt to remove many of these cases based on the federal concerns associated with them by the defendants in these cases. And so there was a period of time in which these cases lagged because of this inability to determine where exactly they were going to be heard on the merits. And those cases were ultimately, the Supreme Court did not, that most of those cases that were removed were remanded. And then the Supreme Court refused to hear any case on those remand motions. And ultimately that led to an understanding that these cases would stay in state court. And ultimately that's because federal defenses, except for a few areas of exceptions, do not allow for, cannot be used as a base for removal. So the plaintiffs have been very effective at keeping the four corners of their complaints focused on state law issues rather than identifying the key federal issues that are necessarily going to come into play in these cases. So I think it's important to at least understand why these cases are not ending up in federal courts. Second bucket of concerns is about the scope of these claims. Public nuisance as a tort was meant to be something which controlled things like blocking the public roads and other ways in which there was an actual interference with some kind of land-based concern, and not to be an avenue or a vehicle for any kind of public right to be asserted or any kind of public health issue to be asserted. And so, we can have a further discussion on what's the appropriate scope of public nuisance, but we are seeing the courts being asked to essentially legislate in this field as a result of the claims rather than to be acknowledging a pre-existing cause of action. In addition, the consumer deception claims have been being added in part because I think a recognition of the weakness of the public nuisance claims. And the consumer deception claims have their own issues as to whether or not they fit within the purposes of the statutes and also, again, meet the evidentiary requirements of proof for unique and knowledge that was kept away from the public in these cases. And finally, as to the scope of the claims, it's important to think about this in relation to products liability, because although Professor Gerard mentioned that products liability is sometimes pled in these cases, the alternative causes of action are sometimes designed to get around the strictures of products liability, which itself was a kind of compromise in the tort law system to allow for an increased amount of liability, but with protections for levels of proof. And so the elements of public nuisance and consumer deception and others do not require that the plaintiffs meet the strict levels of proof in products liability. And so, again, there's some pleading sort of manipulation here as an attempt to get around some of the traditional moorings of the law. The next bucket, which I'll probably skip past in the nature of time, is just to understand we have to be asking ourselves, what's the appropriate role of courts? Given the wicked nature nature of this and the complexity of it all that was presented at our moderator's opening. One question is, are courts even capable of handling these issues either as a claim resolution matter or even as an evidentiary matter when there are so many complex factors and the need to balance those factors against the trade-offs in economic growth, the trade-offs in consumer welfare that can come from increased liability for this important activity in the energy sphere. And those are the kinds of decisions we normally commit to the legislative branches and or to regulatory policy rather than to litigation. And another reason why we should lean heavily on Congress and what Congress has already said and what Congress is capable of doing in order to resolve climate issues rather than expecting the courts to do that. The courts are also ill-suited because of the complex nature and scope of the potential contributors to this. Normally, we require that tort suits go against actual tortfeasors and that they are liable only for their contribution to the overall effect. Here, we have a few people amongst trillions who are contributors to climate change effects that are being singled out as the ones who should be paying for the bills of these projects, which are going to be funded as a result of the lawsuits payouts. And that is not normally what we expect the tort system to be accomplishing, that kind of wealth redistribution for purposes of funding public programs. But instead, we again look to the legislatures and regulatory bodies to do so. They're also ill-suited because this is backward-looking and retroactive. These are not things which could have been anticipated as liabilities on the part of any of the defendants in these cases. And as a consequence, they were unable to adjust their behavior. The entire reason to use torts is to allow people to predict what their liabilities might be, so they adjust their behavior accordingly and react. And that also cannot be done when you are providing retroactive liability, which also creates due process and rule of law problems. There are also due process problems with traceability, causation, and attribution issues here, which ultimately will need to be litigated. And we're kind of at the end of Professor Girard's mention that once we actually get to the merits of these cases or past the sort of initial motion to dismiss, those will need to be determined. And it's very difficult to trace specific harms in specific communities to specific defendants, again, showing why litigation is not perhaps the appropriate tool. I'll end my last, because I only have a few seconds here to mention on the preemption point, which I think we should discuss more in the Q&A, is that AP versus Connecticut did leave open a hole. I think the Boulder case is an opportunity for the court to take and resolve that. The court is eventually going to have to resolve what did AEP mean for state law claims. They're going to have to do it someday, so they really should do it sooner rather than allowing these cases, as many of them are seeming to do, proceed to be very costly litigation, and instead give a clear answer one way or the other as to whether or not these things are preempted. I do not think that the endangerment finding going away should have any impact on the preemption finding because Congress also has the ability to choose not to regulate in a space. And the Clean Air Act itself is making choices which kinds of pollutants it wants to control, which kinds of emissions it wants to control, and which ones it does not. And the if I choose not to decide, I still have made a choice. That should be a part of Congress's prerogative and or the executive's prerogative as to their discretion as to which kinds of activities they want to pursue. That does not mean that it leaves the gate open for states to fill some kind of void. And so I think that's a dangerous argument that would allow for a lot of preemption to get swallowed up and is not particularly persuasive. But we can talk about that and more reasons why when we get to the Q&A. So I'll stop there.
Excellent. I always like it when there's a good Rush quote that appeals to my 18-year-old self very much. Mr. Bookbinder, off to you.
Okay. First, let me disclose that for many years, I was part of the legal team representing the city of Boulder County in that case. We had a companion case, San Miguel County, and poor San Miguel County keeps getting overshadowed by Boulder. I am still privy to the communications and deliberations of the legal team, but I no longer take an active part in the case. And right now, the Supreme Court has asked Boulder to respond to the cert petition. The initial response was to waive responding to it. The court has asked for a response, and my former colleagues are quite busy on it, and it gives me an even longer list of emails to ignore on a daily basis. Let's take this back to, you know, why these cases are brought. We have climate change. All the defendants have admitted climate change is real. You ought to read there. If you want to see something really interesting, is you should read their securities disclosure, where they are falling all over each other to talk about climate change. Yes, it's real, and our products contribute to it. So we have increased government costs as a result of climate change. That is the issue. And I can tell you that for even a small plaintiff like Boulder, there are increased wildfire prevention, increased wildfire fighting. There is an issue of making sure there are adequate water supplies. There are small things like all of a sudden Boulder has to air condition its schools because now in September, they have temperatures in the 90s. They never had that before. So it's everything from very small things to very large things that are affecting local governments. The largest one is, in fact, most roads in Colorado counties are dirt roads. And when you get increased freeze-thaw cycles, you get much, much greater destruction of those roads. And I believe that might be the single biggest cost that Boulder County is looking for, if I remember correctly. So these are basic government services that local governments are now trying to figure out, how do we pay for the increased cost of these? We can either tax our local citizens, or we can try to get compensation from the producers. And here's what they think of it. And look at it this way. You have a defendant, and the defendant makes a product. And at some point, they become aware that their product is going to have tremendous adverse consequences. Not initially, certainly not when, you know, they're putting petroleum products on the markets in the 1920s or 30s. But at some point, they become aware that, yes, what we're making is going to cause huge problems. At that point, they do one of two things. They either say absolutely nothing and simply conceal their knowledge, or they go out and actively mislead the public about it. So that's the situation. And by the way, whether or not they say nothing or actively mislead the public, at the same time, their business plan is to increase the production and use of the products that they know have terribly adverse consequences. So given that, I can understand why state and local governments confronted with these increased costs are going, okay, let's go to court and see if we can be compensated for our increased costs. And it's interesting to hear a lot of conservative and libertarian economists and lawyers arguing that, you know, tort law is not the remedy, when for decades that community of law professors and lawyers said, don't regulate, don't legislate. The only way to deal with pollution is through common law tort liability. That was the way to deal with it. And now that it is being addressed that way, all of a sudden, no, we didn't really mean that. When it comes to common law liability, it's not two things. One, all liability is retroactive. There's no such thing as, you know, non-retroactive liability. You did something and now you pay for it. So all liability is retroactive. Secondly, is the issue of, oh, these defendants are being singled out. No, they're not, because essentially the tort liability is an indirect carbon tax. You sue an oil company is liable. The oil company then passes that liability on to the people who are buying its products. In some sense, it is the most efficient way. The people who buy those products are now going to be paying for the cost imposed by those products. I prefer an actual carbon tax, but if we can't get one of those, and I don't think anyone on this panel would agree that Congress is likely to take on climate change anytime soon, So this is a rather, you know, somewhat convoluted way to achieve the goals of a carbon tax. The people who use the products pay for the damage that they cause. The results, if the plaintiffs start winning, are interesting. I think it's one of the scenarios that has come up is simply once the first plaintiff gets a final non-appealable judgment, no one else gets paid because every defendant in all these cases immediately declares bankruptcy because they have to. If, let's say, Oakland wins final non-appealable judgment the next day, I imagine every jurisdiction in California files a case. All they have to do then is, you know, all the legal issues are decided. The only question is how much are their damages? So I think the defendants in these cases are aware of what would happen and that they have two strategies. One would be, if this looks like it's going to happen, go to Congress, get immunity in exchange for a carbon tax. I think that's a scenario that they have actively considered. If they don't succeed at that, and these cases, you know, we get final non-appealable judgments, all these companies declare bankruptcy, those assets will continue to produce. There's no doubt in anyone's mind, they're not going to, you know, you go into bankruptcy and the bankruptcy court, its job is to make sure that the assets are then used for the benefit of the creditors. Those assets will continue to produce. Oil and gas will not suddenly stop coming on the market. They'll be marketed in different ways because whoever buys those assets will start out by saying on day one, hi, I'm Bob's Oil Company. And let me tell you, every time you pump a gallon of this stuff, you're going to be causing real bad problems. And we admit that right up front. And we're going to put a dollar figure on the cost of these products to make sure that we can pay for the damage that you are causing when you use our products. So that's what, you know, that's my basic view of how these cases are unfolding. Two things I want to say. First of all, I don't think it was a quick pivot from AEP, which is decided in 2011, to the first of the state law cases, which was in 2017. I think it was a rather slow pivot. And I think only one case was initially filed in federal court. That was the City of New York case. And that was because if you've practiced in New York state courts, you know that the case is going to take 15 years regardless. It's just the way New York state courts are for this kind of litigation. And I think New York's consideration was, we don't even want to be trying to pursue a defendant in our state courts. So let's just try bringing a state law claim in federal court. The last thing I want to mention, and if I've gone over my time, please forgive me, Michael, is if the endangerment finding is successfully repealed, then Connecticut versus AEP is effectively overturned. And it brings back federal common law. It may bring back federal common law. Madam, you're shaking your head. I'd really be interested. I mean, this is just kind of guesswork, depending how endangerment is taken away and what the courts say about it. I'm thinking it could bring back federal common law, and then that would displace the state common law. It's a mess. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. So anyway, the whole thing is incredibly complex and convoluted. And then as Professor Cochin and Michael talked about, the proof issues down the road are massively complex. So with that, I'll stop pontificating and turn it over to Adam.
Thanks, David. I didn't mean to vigorously shake my head in disapproval.
Adam knows the renewable fuel standards, so you know there's
well, so does David. When I was working with Boyden David was working with Boyden too. And so this feels like a family reunion in many ways. Look, I'm not nearly the subject matter expert that the other three panelists and you and our moderator are. I'm grateful to be part of the conversation because I find these issues very interesting and challenging in many ways. And I think I'm going to dedicate most of my remarks to highlighting four sort of interesting complicating factors that I'm just sort of watching as this case and the many others play out. But I'll just put my priors out there, first of all. Just watching this case and some cases like it, I've always thought that the main issues were straightforward, and I thought the Second Circuit's decision in the New York case got it right. That at least going back to the city of Milwaukee case in 1981, and obviously with antecedents far before it, it's been pretty well settled in the Supreme Court that questions of public nuisance, particularly with environmental harms related to both water and air, are generally governed by a system of federal common law, which I'll get back to in a second. That I thought that made it pretty straightforward. I agreed with the AEP decision, the unanimous decision saying that the Clean Air Act displaced the federal common law in the context of global climate change. And so for me, that's a pretty straightforward syllogy that any state laws touching on interstate nuisance on these issues would be displaced by the federal common law, which in turn was preempted by federal common law, which in turn was displaced by the balances struck by the legislation of the Clean Air Act. Again, I think the Second Circuit was right. And where I started shaking my head at the end of David's remarks, my friend David's remarks, it's something I've been watching really closely, how the Trump administration would frame and phrase its rollback of the endangerment finding, because I do think that a rollback of the endangerment finding depend on how it's phrased and framed, and not just nominally, but really in substance, I think could have an impact on these legal issues. But I think by my reading of the notice of proposed rulemaking so far on the endangerment finding rollback, I take the Trump administration to be saying that they are not disputing the underlying statutory interpretation, right? That the Clean Air Act itself does, pursuant to Massachusetts versus EPA, that it does touch on climate change because the statute treats greenhouse gas emissions as a pollutant. The administration, I don't think, is disputing that at this point. I think they're simply saying that the factual record as they see it does not reach the level of endangerment. So it's not a dispute that the Clean Air Act touches on greenhouse gas emissions. It's that the Clean Air Act's factual predicates haven't been triggered vis-a-vis greenhouse gas emissions. I know that's, to say the least, a hugely disputed question. But I think so far the Trump administration has been careful in avoiding the notion that what it's rolling back is not just the endangerment finding, but also, in effect, Massachusetts versus EPA. So I don't see the endangerment finding so far as really affecting the legal analysis here. But I don't want to oversimplify the issues here. To be really clear here, we live in a federal government of 50 states, a federal system, and we should be very, very wary of glib preemption of state laws. The states are the building blocks of our government from the ground up, and so we shouldn't take that lightly. We also, especially for a conservative like me, should be very, very wary of legal doctrines like the Dormant Commerce Clause, which are not written explicitly in the Constitution. Now, I will say, and this goes way back to the first stage of my legal career, where I was an energy lawyer at Baker Botts working on federal natural gas issues. I've always been convinced, even before I was getting paid to agree with this point, that federal law largely preempts state regulation of a lot of these interstate matters, and that the Dormant Commerce Clause, while not explicit in the Constitution, is there. And so I'm instinctually sympathetic, I'll say, to the preemption and Dormant Commerce Clause arguments undergirding all of this. But I don't think we should do that lightly. I think we need to be very careful, especially conservatives. We should be very careful with these sorts of doctrines. And we also, by the way, should be very, very wary of the predicate of the Milwaukee case, the notion of federal common law, right? Going all the way back to the Erie case we all studied in our first year of law school, the baseline assumption is that there is not federal common law in general. To the extent it still exists, it's an exception. It's an exceptional doctrine. And so we should think of the Milwaukee decision as exceptional, and we should always be very careful about extending it. Okay, so I generally agree, like I said, with the Second Circuit case. I think the Second Circuit got it exactly right. But I'm trying not to be glib here, and I'll encourage our viewers, wherever they are on these issues, to be very careful, not just with disagreeing with me, but with agreeing with me. These are very complicated issues. And speaking of complications, here's the four complications that I am watching as this plays out now, especially now that we've reached the Supreme Court. I thought in the past the Supreme Court might pick up a case like this. I wrote an op-ed urging them to take an earlier iteration of this case on the removal question. They didn't take it up. I wonder now if the issues haven't crystallized enough, especially in this case, to make it really ripe for Supreme Court review, especially in light of the Trump administration Justice Department's brief. I'll be very curious to see what the city of Boulder says. The four complications I'm watching are this. First of all, federalism and the interstate and interstate commerce. We're right on the heels of the National Pork Producers case, which as an Iowan still hurts me to my very core. The idea of California regulating those fine, you know, salt of the earth farmers in my home state of Iowa. The Supreme Court has long been wary, and I think in some ways increasingly wary, of the Dormant Commerce Clause. And they've been increasingly open to states having a pretty big footprint in national policymaking. And I'm very curious to see if that trend continues here, if the court takes up this case. My second complication here that I'm watching is related to that one. It's that on questions of federalism, preemption, Dormant Commerce Clause undergirding these issues, we've seen the states speak in terms over and over again of the doctrine of equal dignity or equal sovereignty. The states have increasingly framed these issues, not in terms of the national federal government's power over the states, but the states' interests vis-a-vis one another. They invoke cases like Franchise Tax Board versus Hyatt from 2019, and cases going back a century on the doctrine of equal state dignity, equal state sovereignty. And I'm curious the extent to which the Supreme Court will pick up that notion, because I think that is a slightly different spin on the old familiar Dormant Commerce Clause arguments we've seen, which have been assertions of federal power over the states. Now we have states pushing back against other states to defend their own sovereign interests, their own what they frame as dignity. And I'm very curious to see the extent to which the Supreme Court picks up that thread. The third complication I'm watching is the gravitational pull that our modern era of regulatory whiplash has on this case. As David pointed out, we're now in the era of the Trump administration rolling back the endangerment finding, just as it's trying to roll back almost 30 other policies from the Biden administration, the Obama administrations. We live in this regime change era of politics where each new administration, whenever we see a party change, comes in with an enormous regulatory or deregulatory agenda, triggered by a flurry of executive orders. It's enormously destabilizing for all of us, for companies, for individuals, for nonprofits, for state governments, for everybody. And so much of this litigation is in the shadow of these enormous policy whiplashes from one administration to the other that I think is largely fed by the lack of clarity and specificity in the underlying federal statutes. I think the Supreme Court increasingly recognizes that at the federal level, this is enormously destabilizing and demoralizing to all of us. And I'm kind of curious to see how the court takes those sorts of considerations in. Obviously, it's not front and center in the case, but it looms over all of this. And I'm curious to see how the court channels its interest in legal certainty and predictability into this kind of litigation. And then last, and I'm sorry for going on for so long, the last question or complication is what I call federalism and realpolitik. For us lawyers, it's easy to get pretty, pretty specific, pretty quick, to take these cases one slice at a time in very discrete cases and very discrete legal issues. But of course, they're occurring against a much larger political and legal backdrop. And I'm curious to see the extent to which those implicit background questions are brought explicitly into the case by the litigants or even by the justices. Some of the examples we've already heard in this. What's the relationship between these cases in state law and the AEP decision, which took the federal common law claims off the board? Will the justices see this as simply an effort to relitigate the basic disputes that were originally sought to be litigated under federal common law? Oftentimes, the litigators in these cases, their worst enemies are their own friends, the politicians and others, who speak much more broadly and sweepingly about these cases than the lawyers themselves do. I've noticed that's not so much the case here. City of Boulder has been very careful, I think, in their public statements, or at least very precise in their public statements. They really have over and over again framed this in terms of local impacts. And I think that's, for an advocate for these, it's exactly the right way to think about these things. I think in New York and more broadly, the rhetoric has been a bit more sweeping, not just from the governments and the politicians, but also from some of the outside groups. We've seen groups like Arabella Advisors and others really cite these cases as dovetailing with the broader effort to bring political and legal pressure on corporations through shareholder votes and through the risk of liability. I think it was David that referred to the disclosure documents that energy companies put out now. I think everybody outside of these cases recognizes that these cases dovetail intentionally or accidentally with the broader political and legal and shareholder pressures that are being brought on energy companies to change the way the companies do business, to regulate themselves, to regulate these companies outside of the explicit federal regulatory framework. I'm curious what the court will make of that. And finally, I'm curious what the court will make of the multiplicity of cases. We keep talking about the Suncor case, the City of Boulder case. We've been alluding to some other cases, Hawaii and the Second Circuit litigation. But as Professor Girard pointed out at the very outset, there are, 33 cases like this right now? The court, even when it hears one case, has to decide these issues with a view to all of these cases. And the more that you pan back and you see the broad galaxy of cases bringing these kinds of claims, it's harder to think of them as sort of one by one cases about legal impacts. It's inevitable that we'll start to think of them as a sum total. And I'm curious to the extent to which the court takes that reality seriously, too. I wish I had taken the reality of my clock more seriously. I'm sorry for going on so long, Michael, and my co-panelists, so I'll leave it at that.
Well, thank you to all of you. Very briefly, because we are running tight on time, if there are any responses that anyone is dying to get out before I go to Q&A.
Can I just say one thing about the role of Congress here? I mean, I think most people would agree that ideally Congress would fix the problem, but Congress is stuck. Congress has not passed a major environmental law since 1990. We've had 35 years of congressional paralysis. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act was not a regulatory law. It was a lot of subsidies, many of which have been taken back, but Congress has not acted in no small part because a lot of the defendants in these cases have been very effective in their lobbying or their campaign contributions. So in the absence of congressional action, lawyers look for whatever tools there are, and that's one reason why we have so many of these cases and so many other kinds of cases, and why they will continue. The IPCC has said, growing out of the Paris Climate Agreement, that 1.5 degrees is sort of the maximum tolerable. Any scientist who says that we might not get to 1.5 degrees until 2100 is an outlier. We are right now hovering at about 1.5 degrees. And the latest estimates from the IPCC and others are that by the end of the century, we're likely to be about 2.7 degrees, which by any calculus is catastrophic. So given the seriousness of what's already happening, it's not in the distant future. We're already having unprecedented heat waves. and wildfires and extreme precipitation and other impacts that are clearly worsened by climate change. I think the legal pressure will continue and will intensify in every forum that lawyers can think of.
I would say briefly on that. I know I've gone on long, but I agree that Congress needs to get into the game. But I can think of no better way over the last 30 years to drain all the hydraulic pressure out of Congress than to cede this entirely to the EPA, to state regulators, or to lawsuits, as we've done for 30 years. I remember when President Obama came to office in 2009 and challenged Congress to legislate on this. He said, if you don't, I will. And the moment he said that was the moment there was no reason for Congress to legislate. We all knew where this was headed. In some ways, the only way to bring this back to Congress, and this is a recurring theme of the Roberts Court, is to make it is to recognize and reiterate the limits on these alternative forms of regulation, both in agencies and outside of them, to channel the hydraulic forces back into Congress, to really force them to grapple with this generational issue that needs Congress's intervention.
I can add one other thing on that, that is the courts are not meant to be a backstop for gridlock or for a dysfunctional Congress. So I have no doubt that the litigators would like to use the courts because they are frustrated with the existence of the political process or what kind of gains that can be had there. But the constitutional design is actually one designed to create gridlock. It's one to make legislation difficult. It's one to make regulation difficult by placing high costs on achieving the ends through the political processes. And you are actually subverting the intentionally high cost barriers to producing legislation if you are asking the courts to produce it when you can't get it through the normal processes through a cheaper mechanism. And so there is a, you know, our separation of powers is designed not only to ensure that the pressure is on the right branches to do the right things, but it's also to ensure that that if it's not being done there, we have to sort of accept it and or put that pressure on, because there's not a alternative way to say when Congress isn't doing so well, the courts will pick up the slack in order to achieve some kind of policy ends that we believe people actually want. It's a poor testing ground for that as well, because there's very little opportunity to figure out what outcome is best achieved. Comparative institutional competency just rests with the regulators and the legislatures in this space, not with courts.
So those all touch on a theme that I want to ask about. In particular, David, I thought your comment about the de facto carbon tax is right, but it strikes me as concerning in some respects that you would then allocate that tax not across an industry or people generally, but against a specific set of private entities, like I mentioned in my opening remarks or my intro, the state-owned companies. We could put tariffs on them. We could tax them if they're operating here. That doesn't hold when you're talking about tort liability. It also doesn't. There are some. It's hard for me also to see how you're right that that things would just go on with pass through costs when part of public nuisance is abatement. And it seems to me that if you're going to abate something caused by the production and sale of fossil fuels, that would just mean doing less of it or none of it. It's, I guess, the two points that I would be curious for your thoughts on are what are the distributive effects here, given that you're trying to use litigation to accomplish a carbon tax, but you can't allocate that across the entire industry or even across the entire subset of industry that is the fossil fuel producers and retailers and sellers. and then two, what is the solution if you're asking, if you're not saying that something is going to be abated, how then is this a public nuisance? It seems to me almost a contradiction in terms if it's not going to be abated.
Let me start with the carbon tax end of that. It's the defendants might be relatively small in number, but in some cases it's every company that has produced produced or marketed fossil fuels in the United States. So it's huge numbers of defendants. The Boulder case has two. But the point is they would then pass these costs on. That's what corporations do. And the idea would then be the people purchasing the products would actually be paying for the harm that those products cause. That is, you know, if we got that through a carbon tax, if a carbon tax raised the price of gas at the pump by 50 cents, or liability of the corporation raises the price at the pump by 50 cents, either way, the person purchasing it is paying for the damage that that product causes. So we think that's an effective way of doing that. But when you talked about, when Adam talked about my client keeping focused on the fact that they're dealing with, you know, how do we make up these budget numbers? That's real. There is nothing realer than a local government trying to deal with road costs. It doesn't get any more basic. Where are we going to get the money to keep our roads in shape? Where are we going to get the money to make sure we have water supplies? Where are we going to get money to fight fires? These are basic government services, and they are looking desperately for a means of paying for those things. So it's, you know, this is, it'd be great if Congress had acted or were to act, but I agree with Michael. I don't think that's going to happen anytime, you know, anytime in the near future, anytime in the future at all. So I would go and say there are times when courts are required or called upon. I would look back to Brown versus Board of Education. People have been screaming about racial discrimination in the United States to state legislatures and to Congress for decades. And so I guess, are you trying to say that those plaintiffs should have just been, you know, sat back and waited more decades till Congress or states took action? Or were they, yeah, and they were wrong to appeal to courts?
Well, I mean, I think the rejoinder to that would be something like, there was a constitutional amendment that guaranteed no race discrimination, and then that was just ignored, which is rather different, I think, from saying that a particular set of companies need to be de facto taxed for something that has upsides and downsides. And I don't know. I think that's what you'd probably hear if you asked that question to, you know, to the folks at that time.
Can I ask David one quick question? So I know we have to have a totally separate webinar to talk about the climate superfund laws at some point, but one of the main arguments coming out of those legislatures is that these kinds of liability costs associated with either the climate superfunds or these tort suits would not be passed on. So do you find that not persuasive then?
I have not heard anyone say that if Exxon is found liable, it would not pass those costs on to its customers. I can't imagine that a rational business wouldn't pass on those costs. That's what rational businesses do.
One of the issues there is the depth or the length of the retroactivity. It's very hard to pass on costs that were ostensibly incurred 30 years ago, I think would be one of the rejoinders. But Professor Cochin, you're the expert on that. I think we have already edged past our time limit here. I have so many more questions, and we didn't even get to the audience questions, some of which were quite a bit of fun. So I think we'll just have to get the band back together again sometime soon and do this again.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Sounds great.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for your valuable time and expertise today. I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And keep your eye on your emails and our website for announcements about more upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.